From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The U.S. is out. Here's President Trump in the Rose Garden yesterday.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
Back in 2015, the landmark deal brought all but two countries together to voluntarily pledge to lower greenhouse gas emissions to fight climate change. But President Trump said the agreement imposed unfair standards on U.S. workers and on the country. His move fulfills a campaign promise to his supporters, but at what cost? This hour on Point, the U.S. exits the Paris Climate Accord. You can join us on air or online. Do you support the president's decision, or do you think it's a mistake? If a mistake, how big? Just symbolic or something that will make a measurable negative influence? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Robinson Meyer. He writes about climate change for The Atlantic. You can find links to his work at our website, onpointradio.org. Rob, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Sasha. Thank you for having me.
So could you give us an overview of what this accord did? It's been pointed out that it is a voluntary agreement. On the other hand, it brought together almost the entire world. It was an effort to bring together rich and poor to set goals to curb carbon emissions. What did it do exactly?
So in December of 2015, more than 190 countries in the world got together, and they made a commitment together that they thought climate change was an important issue for the world to address, and they were committed to not only keeping global temperature below 2 degrees Celsius, but actually aiming to keep the rising global temperature, below 1.5 degrees Celsius, which would stave off some of the worst, most dangerous consequences of allowing global warming to increase by 2 degrees Celsius.
And this was a carrot, not stick approach, meaning really
exactly.
No penalties.
Exactly. So that was the goal. What actually happened is that all those countries came to Paris with their own plan for how they were going to reduce their own emissions. And there was no at least public haggling between countries about whether they could reduce their emissions more. You came with your promise. They were worked out before the agreement. All the countries made their promises together. And then they agreed on a common timetable starting in 2020 to come together again and for everyone to ratchet up their agreement. So as technology developed, as things became cheaper, and as hopefully there was more and more public appetite for carbon aggressive climate policy, you would be able to ratchet up everyone's agreement, everyone's plan, until eventually we got to the point where we could keep global temperature rise below 2 degrees C and hopefully below 1.5 degrees C.
Before yesterday, when the U.S. pulled out of the accord, the only two countries not to be part of it were Syria and Nicaragua. Why did they not join?
Well, so Syria has been in the middle of a civil war since 2011, basically well before the really meaty negotiations on Paris started. And Nicaragua.
In other words, they just had other things to worry about?
They have other things to worry about, exactly. Nicaragua is not part of the agreement because they, at this point, I think are almost 90% powered by renewable energy. They felt that the Paris Agreement, because it didn't involve penalties for countries that didn't have aggressive climate policies, and it didn't involve penalties for countries that didn't uphold the commitments they made under Paris, was too weak to combat climate change. And because of that, they said, we're not party to this agreement. We're handling this issue by ourselves, and we don't want to legitimize this agreement anymore by being there for something that we feel is inappropriate. Hmm.
Tiny Nicaragua took that stand.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the Central American countries are really actually doing fairly well on renewables. Costa Rica at this point is almost also 100% renewable powered.
Now, Trump himself, in explaining why he is pulling out of this agreement, said it's time to exit and pursue a new deal that he thinks will better protect American companies.
It is time to put Youngstown, Ohio, Detroit, Michigan, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, along with many, many other locations within our great country, before Paris, France.
He also said that he felt that this accord was unfair to U.S. citizens.
As someone who cares deeply about the environment, which I do, I cannot in good conscience support a deal that punishes the United States, which is what it does.
Rob Meyer, how does he think it punished the United States?
Well, the argument from the Trump administration has been that the United States is making a fairly aggressive promise under Paris. It's promising to cut its carbon emissions 25% below 2005 levels, basically by the middle of next decade. And China and India are not making a promise to also to cut their carbon levels by the middle of next decade. Their carbon levels will keep rising. But what they are promising to do is reduce the carbon intensity of their economies. So for every person in their economies, they're both promising to reduce how much carbon basically enters the atmosphere for that individual producing unit in their economy.
So it sounds like the United States is being held to a higher standard in a sense, which is different than a punishment. So what would be punishing about this?
I would say that we held ourselves to that standard because all countries came to Paris with their own deal. So that was our deal under our promise under Paris is basically the sum of what all the Obama regulatory climate policies would have gotten us to. So we already have policies in place. I mean, the policies are in place right now, although they are being undone by the Trump administration, that would allow us to have met our Paris Accord, our Paris commitment. I think, and China and India also brought their own promise to the table.
But going back to Trump's word, because I'm really fascinated by the word punishes, he says, "I cannot in good conscience support a deal that punishes the United States." What about this deal did he think did that?
From the president's argument, from the president's speech, it sounds like he believes the fact that we are making more aggressive carbon commitments under Paris is a punishment. However, there's nothing in the Paris deal that wouldn't let him come back with a different national commitment that was weaker and involved fewer carbon cuts, fewer reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. There's nothing in Paris that wouldn't prevent him from doing that. So I think what he sees as a punishment is that our commitment isn't the same as China's and India's, but there's nothing keeping him from reducing that punishment by himself.
Rob, Trump did talk about China in India and how he feels like they, and it's not so much got off easily, but just didn't make as grand promises as the U.S. did. So he referenced China and its plan to build additional coal plants.
In short, the agreement doesn't eliminate coal jobs. It just transfers those jobs out of America and the United States and ships them to foreign countries.
So President Trump has also made the argument that this is an accord that would cost America money and it would also cost Americans to lose their jobs. Do we have any numbers showing whether there really would have been a job loss resulting?
I haven't seen I think the most economic models do not show a job loss from this. And even when you look at the most aggressive of the Obama climate policies, for example, the Clean Power Plan, which reduced greenhouse gas emissions from the electricity sector, even there, when you look at what kind of economic consequences would be, rates were not projected to rise for, say, utility ratepayers under any of the models until the late 2020s, at which point there'd be further technological developments and the models kind of, I think, break down. I would also say that at this point, the renewable energy industry, the solar photovoltaic industry in the United States employs twice as many people as the coal industry. And so if what we're talking about here is supporting jobs in the supporting industries in the United States that employ the most Americans, it would seem like boosting the renewable energy industry, which employs a whole lot of Americans right now, a whole lot more than coal or natural gas, or at least a whole lot more than coal, would seem to be the more strategic choice.
Let's go to a caller from Windsor, Vermont. This is Roy. Roy, welcome to On Point. And what do you think about the United States' decision to exit the Paris Climate Accord?
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, honestly, I thought it was really good news. I'm pretty happy to hear it. By the UN's own models, they suggest that by the end of the century, if we were to follow through with the agreement, the impact on the temperature would only be 0.057 degrees temperature reduction. And that's projected to cost the American taxpayer $100 trillion. Pretty big price tag, essentially an infinitesimal change. This seems like a huge win for the American taxpayer, to not have to pay into.
Roy, thanks for that. Rob Meyer of The Atlantic, could you give a fact check on that? Do you know whether those numbers are correct?
Yeah, I have not heard anything related to the $100 trillion number. All of the commitments that the U.S. made under Paris were done through regulatory mechanisms, and for them to be done through regulatory mechanisms, they have to pay for themselves. The benefits have to exceed the costs. So, for example, the Clean Power Plan pays for itself, at least the argument the Obama administration made, and the one that's supported by models, is that it pays for itself through public health benefits. So as we phase out coal plants, we have fewer asthma attacks, less early mortality, fewer heart and lung problems, and that the benefits in terms of medical costs, you know, outweigh any costs that come from switching technology over in the grid.
Let's fit in one more caller before we go to a break. This is a caller from Miami, Florida, Jacob. Jacob, welcome to On Point. Your thoughts about exiting Paris.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for this topic. I really appreciate it. I supported the president for office, and I was skeptical of climate change. But over the years, just hearing about it more and really learning about the science behind it and how we know these things, I've taken a different approach, and I'm kind of disappointed that the president pulls out. I understand the controversy, but at my point of view is, what's the severe risk if things really could get this bad in global climate? You got to at least do something, even if the impact is not going to be that bad. And instead of talking about how many jobs will be lost, let's pull some of our monies into retraining workers.
Jacob, thanks for that. It sounds like you're making in part the argument that what's the harm of at least having a seat at the negotiating table, which we'll discuss after a break. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about President Trump's announcement that the U.S. will leave the Paris Climate Accord, the first international deal to combat climate change. Join this conversation. Let us know what you see as the benefits of Trump's decision, the consequences. Do you consider it a smart move, or are you sorry to see it happen? Still with us from Washington is Rob Meyer, who writes about climate change for The Atlantic. And joining us from Washington is Christy Goldfuss, former managing director at the White House Council on Environmental Quality under President Obama. Christy is now vice president of energy and environment policy at the Center for American Progress, a liberal organization. Christy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. And with us from Hartford, Connecticut, is Oren Kass, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank. Oren's work focuses on energy, the environment, and anti-poverty policy. He was also a former domestic policy director for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. Oren, welcome to On Point.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Christy, could you give us your perspective on how you feel about what happened yesterday, the U.S. exit?
Yes, Sasha. It was really sad day for American and U.S. leadership. I mean, I think it's telling if you look at who was in the Rose Garden with the president yesterday. In the various rows, you had representatives from Heritage Foundation, Competitive Enterprise Institute, and really who was not there were any of the CEOs from Exxon, Shell, GE, Tesla. And you ask why? Because all of those CEOs opposed the announcement that was happening yesterday. So really, the president surrounded himself with the sole people who support this decision, which are really conservative folks. We see more than 1,000 businesses, leaders across this country. You have Elon Musk from Tesla even pulling out of the councils that the president has right now, because business has moved on. Business knows we need to act. And the president was really isolated with his sole base of supporters yesterday.
Oren Kass of the Manhattan Institute, I presume you have a different perspective?
Well, I think the problem with the Paris Agreement is that it was poorly designed. It wasn't going to accomplish anything for climate change, and it was going to put the U.S. in a very bad position globally, given the strong commitment we made and the lack of commitment from anybody else. So I think it's sensible to not want to be a part of such an arrangement, and I think it should be evaluated on its merits, not on the basis of which side business leaders are on. Certainly that's not something environmentalists typically emphasize, and I'm especially sure it's not relevant for someone like Elon Musk, who's entire business model relies on government subsidies for his green energy project. So
what's the difficult position you think it put the U.S. in?
Well, what's happened is because, as Rob was describing earlier, the commitments are purely voluntary. And so from a lot of the world, we got commitments to essentially continue with business as usual, especially from large developing countries. On behalf of America, President Obama went and made a very aggressive commitment that would be very hard to meet, even implementing all of his own policies. And so what we've already seen now as a year or two has gone by is you see everybody applauding India and China. Look, they're right on track. Look, they're ahead of track. Well, of course they are because their pledge didn't ask them to do anything else, whereas the U.S. is now under all this pressure to meet these objectives that President Obama set.
But could you argue that if any country is going to set a high bar for itself, it should be the U.S.? And how does that disadvantage us?
Well, it disadvantages us diplomatically if we then become the country that everybody else wants to kick. And so I think it's terrific if the U.S. wants to set high standards for itself. But the premise of an international negotiation and an international agreement is in theory supposed to be that we get everybody to make strong commitments. We tried that many times all the way up through 2009 in Copenhagen, and it always failed because other countries wouldn't make strong commitments. Unfortunately, President Obama was so desperate to get any agreement, regardless of its substance, that basically the negotiators changed the rules and said, we'll take as little as you want to give us and call it an agreement anyway.
And how does the U.S. – even if other countries you think weren't held to a high enough standard, how does the U.S. end up being kicked around by other countries in the process?
Well, the U.S. will be kicked around because the entire premise of the Paris process is that you're supposed to come back every few years and review how you're doing and see who's doing as well or better or worse than they committed. That's if you were going to say anything good about Paris, it would be that that's supposed to be a useful structure. If you set up that structure and then invite other countries to not hold themselves to any standard and then hold yourself to a really challenging standard, you've now set up a dynamic where everybody else gets applauded for doing nothing and you get criticized for not doing enough. And that is certainly not a diplomatic equation that I think we should be enthusiastic about.
In terms of people weighing in on this, you mentioned Elon Musk. He had been on an advisory council for President Trump regarding this. He said he's going to leave the advisory council as a result. So did Bob Iger, the chief executive of Disney. The CEO of Goldman Sachs, Lloyd Blankfein, tweeted for the first time ever yesterday because of this. He had joined Twitter 6 years ago, but not till yesterday was he compelled to tweet. He wrote, "Today's decision is a setback for the environment and for the U.S.'s leadership position in the world." Let's also hear former Secretary of State John Kerry. He was on NPR's Morning Edition today, and he said that he considers the withdrawal from the accord all political.
"This is political, serving the narrow ideological interest of a narrow base of his party. And really, it's one of the most disastrous, shallow, untruthful decisions the President of the United States has made in my lifetime."
Christy Goldfuss of as you were former managing director under the White House, under President Obama, you know these issues very well. Can you give us your sense of whether this is truly as disastrous as John Kerry says, or as other people say, it was largely a symbolic agreement, it wasn't non-binding, the consequences are not that material? Where do you fall on that?
This is diplomatically disastrous. I mean, this is shameful. The rest of the world is united in attacking this global challenge, and the United States is going to sit on the sidelines. So I think the immediate impact of this is really diplomatic, and that will be felt by the United States in many different areas. I mean, we even have our own Department of Defense with General Mattis referring to climate change as a threat multiplier. So you even have disagreements within the Trump administration about whether this was the right path forward. And when we go to rely on our allies, whether it's Angela Merkel or whether it's France, we're going to have a real challenge in do we keep our word? Are we willing to unite with others? Do we want to have a planet that all of us can inhabit? So that's where I agree with Secretary Kerry. Where I think if there's any silver lining, and I think that comes from the business community, they are moving beyond this. And the markets have really already stepped up in an enormous way. As Rob mentioned earlier, we've seen massive growth in renewables across the country. And that pressure, that move to renewables in this country will continue, especially if this administration doesn't go on for 8 years. I think if we have 4 years of really regressive policies and isolation policies, we will still be able to make progress because that's the trajectory we're on. But it's harder to say what would happen if we had a full 8 years of President Trump.
Let's go to a caller from Lakeland, Florida. This is Mark. And Mark, your perspective on the U.S. departure from the agreement.
Hi, thank you. So I think we should participate in accords, but not in the way that we have been. So my understanding is India and China aren't even expected to implement changes for 5 or more years, and even those changes are very minor. So my real question is, why is it continue to expect the United States to carry the load for the rest of the world in these issues? And why can't we expect that we have a more equal playing field and participation from other large global economies? And by the way, I would challenge those corporations that are boycotting our current administration. Why don't they boycott India and China?
Mark, thanks for that. And Christy, could you address that, since I imagine Oren might agree with that? So Christy Goldfuss, how do you feel about that caller's feeling?
Well, I think what's being overlooked here by both the India narrative and the China narrative is that every country came to this agreement with what they could accomplish. And the United States was already far ahead in our ability to push renewable energy. And really, with our research and development and technology, we're innovators, we're leaders. So we were already ahead of the game. That means we can do more. We're also historically one of the largest polluters in the entire world. That means we have a lot to do in order to make up from the impact and really our role in causing climate change. It's also not correct to say that China and India are not aggressively moving forward. Given how much progress and how much they have to do to catch up to us, they are moving incredibly aggressively. I mean, in terms of China, for example, they plan to increase their non-fossil share of their energy consumption to account for about 20% renewables by 2030. That amounts to 800 to 1,000 gigawatts of capacity, which alone would power the entire U.S. grid. So, you know, every country has a different race to run and has farther to go. And we were already ahead of those countries, which means we can do more. We should do more. But also, if President Trump was really so upset with our target, just as Rob mentioned, he could have put forward a different target and said, the United States is not going to be this aggressive and we're not going to move this far forward. So he could have stayed in the agreement, stayed as a leader in the conversation, but been less aggressive. Instead, he said, no, I'm going to reject the rest of the world. I'm not going to be a part of this agreement. We are no longer going to unite together to address this problem.
Let's go to a caller for Belgium. This is John calling from Brussels. And John, what's your European perspective on this?
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for taking my call. So European and Chinese leaders are meeting in Brussels today, actually, and they're agreeing to boost their cooperation on climate action, specifically on renewable energy. Because like Europe and China, they realize that like there's benefits to meeting this challenge as well. And in fact, the U.S. is just going to get left behind. So I can just give you some numbers just to give kind of the perspective on it. There's 3.5 million renewable energy jobs in China. There's 1 million renewable energy jobs in the EU. And even in the U.S., there's 800,000 jobs in renewable energy. That's 4 times the number of jobs in fossil fuels in the U.S. Imagine how many jobs there'd be in the U.S. with renewable energy providing 100% of the electricity. These are the sorts of benefits, like even economic benefits, that the EU and China are there getting ready to share those benefits, and the U.S. is just going to get left behind.
John, thanks for that perspective. Oren Kass, could you address that caller's question? Because he's talking about this burgeoning, growing clean energy sector with so many jobs in wind and solar and other clean versions. President Trump has said, I need to try to help save coal jobs. But is that really where can he really make a difference there helping that sector? Would it not make more sense to focus on the growing sector of green energy?
Well, you know, I think good economic policy shouldn't focus on counting up the jobs in one industry or another. Good economic policy should be focusing on creating the conditions for for investment and growth. And one important component of that is to make sure that energy is affordable. So if renewable energy can compete in the market, and I know Christy is describing a lot of progress markets are making, I think that's terrific. But we don't need an international agreement for that, and we shouldn't need government subsidies for it either. You know, what I think is really telling about this entire discussion so far is that nobody's actually talking about climate change or the idea that the Paris Agreement was actually going to prevent climate change, because the data shows pretty clearly that it was not going to do that. And so instead we have what is essentially a diplomatic coffee chat for its own sake of people coming together, people criticizing each other. You know, I love hearing that Germany is going to be upset with the United States. U.S. emissions are going down. German emissions have been going up for the last couple of years. And so if we actually want to focus on the tangible problem of climate change, we can talk about what directions emissions are going. If we're trying to defend the Paris Agreement just on the basis that diplomacy is good for its own sake or that we need an international agreement to help our market work well, I think we should be a lot more skeptical of those kinds of arguments that are really just coming in after the fact.
President Trump has said that he's willing to renegotiate the U.S. back into the deal, but he said it would have to be under terms that are fair or that he renegotiated.
We'll sit down with the Democrats and all of the people that represent either the Paris Accord or something that we can do that's much better than the Paris Accord. And I think the people of our country will be thrilled, and I think then the people of the world will be thrilled. But until we do that, we're out of the agreement.
Oren, do you see a renegotiated version that you would feel better about?
Well, I don't really understand what the president means by that. I think his MO as a deal maker encourages him to kind of say that he's going to try to negotiate something. I think the reality is that what Paris really shows is that you can't negotiate an international climate agreement because countries have a lot of interests that they want to pursue that don't have much to do with climate change. You know, the one thing that I think could be very constructive would be to focus more on resilience and adaptation, to recognize that some climate change is going to happen, that we can really prepare for it and minimize its cost if we invest smartly, if we support areas that are likely to face those challenges.
Ideally, wouldn't we do both, prepare for it but also try to stop it or minimize it?
Well, it's fine to say you're going to do both. I think certainly from the Paris perspective, you can see one took precedence over and really crowded out emphasis on the other. So the question is, where can you make the most difference, and therefore where do you want to invest your focus? I think it would be terrific to see a global effort focused on effective adaptation. But I really think, you know, hopefully people will learn by now from Paris that this idea that, you know, if the U.S. just shows enough leadership and makes enough promises, we're going to change the behavior of other countries. It's not realistic, and at the end of the day, it's not a good deal for the U.S. either.
Rob Meyer of The Atlantic, you're still with us. One noteworthy thing here is that Trump's own daughter, Ivanka, had really been urging him to keep that seat at the climate negotiating table. His Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, had also lobbied him to stay part of the accord. So he went against some pretty close advisors. Why do you think he did that?
Well, I think it was a campaign promise the president made, and especially on a day when he also announced that we're keeping the U.S. embassy in Tel Aviv and not moving it to Jerusalem. He's under a lot of pressure to uphold campaign promises, and it does serve. I think the president's perception that this is a deal that elites have pulled over, you know, the working class's eyes is the same argument he made in the election. And I don't think it matches all the facts, but I think it might be effective rhetorically. And I think that ultimately is part of what drove him to leave the agreement.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're getting reaction today about President Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement. Listeners, let us know if you feel this move was a long time coming. Do you see it as short-sighted? What do you think the U.S. could do now to address climate change? Are you sorry or are you feeling like it was a good move that the U.S. left? Joining us from Washington is Rob Meyer, who writes about climate change for The Atlantic. Also with us from Washington is Christy Goldfuss, former managing director of the White House Council on Environmental Quality under President Obama. She's now at the Center for American Progress, a liberal group. And from Hartford, Connecticut, Orrin Cass, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank. His work focuses in part on energy and the environment. Orrin Cass, I want to read to you three comments that have come in on our website. These are from listeners who are disappointed by the U.S. decision. One writes, this was the most belligerent act the U.S. could have committed against the rest of the world short of bombing it. That's obviously very dramatic. Another says, leaving the Paris Accord was a self-centered action. Sorry that Americans are seen as not concerned with the world. Another person writes, I thought America was going to lead from now on. So, Orrin, my question for you is, you know, there are people who support this accord but have acknowledged it was not perfect, but it's an important first step. Other people have said, yes, it has shortcomings, but symbolically, it was so important for the United States to be there at the negotiating table. How do you feel about the symbolic part of this? I mean, as we've said, now it's only Syria, Nicaragua, and the United States. Symbolically, that rings, it's very difficult, I think, for people to absorb that.
Well, I think it's certainly true that the agreement was largely symbolic and that therefore, as a result, the withdrawal is in many respects largely symbolic. I'm not especially persuaded and I don't think many Americans are by the idea that just because everybody else is doing it, that is therefore the reason to do it. In other words, I think there needs to be some substantive case that this is actually something that makes sense for the United States and that's where so often these arguments for the Paris Agreement fall down. You know, I think unfortunately one problem is that going back a couple of years to when we signed this, President Obama really put the U.S. in a tough spot by committing to something that wasn't really in our interest and then just announcing that the U.S. was now a signatory without even seeking approval from Congress. You know, one reason the Constitution expects certainly formal treaties to be ratified by the Senate is that you want to make sure that when we're committing the United States to something on the international stage, there's really a strong consensus for it domestically. And so, you know, Christy mentioned now people are worried that the United States won't keep our word. The problem there is that we had a president who made a promise that he really shouldn't have made in the first place. And so I'd rather see us correct that now than just string things along indefinitely. You know, if this goes on, there's never going to be some point when people say, oh, OK, well, now the United States can change its mind. If it's not a good agreement, the right answer is to call a spade and say it's not a good agreement.
We have a caller from Charlotte, North Carolina. This is Tony. Tony, welcome to On Point. And what do you think about the U.S. decision to leave the Paris Accord?
Well, yesterday was embarrassing and sad. However, let's just try to move on. Coal is not part of the future. So why doesn't local government and these clean air companies go to like West Virginia, the coal country, and set up manufacturing for wind turbines and solar panels and make the transition? It just seems like if I was a millionaire, I would make that kind of investment. What is wrong with that kind of bold suggestion?
Tony, great point. Thanks for that. Let's hear from another caller. This is John from Waterford, Michigan. John, welcome to On Point. Your views on this.
Thank you. Well, listening to your commentary there about all the, you know, how America's going to be left behind, the number of jobs that we've created, the green jobs, and all the companies that are for supporting actions in climate change. You know, what does it matter if we belong to the court? Why don't we just plow ahead and do what's good for America, good for our economy, create all these jobs independent of government action and incentives, and just do what makes sense for us?
John, thanks for that. Christy Goldfuss of the Center for American Progress. We just heard two callers say, the decision was made, move on. We can still make progress towards this goal, even without the U.S. being part of the accord. How do you feel about that? I mean, is that a fair point?
It is a fair point that we can continue to make progress here. And I think all the discussion we had about where the business community is going, I mean, you have almost half of the Fortune 500 companies adopting at least one climate or clean energy goal. Apple runs 100% of its U.S. operations on renewable energy. Walmart has pledged to source half of its energy from renewable sources by 2025. Yes, all of that can continue. And really, I think had this decision been made, had we retreated 10 years ago and the technology and the markets weren't in the shape they were, it would have been a more dire situation. So I think we can certainly go forward with all of that. I just want to point out and correct something that Oren said. I mean, the 0.2 degrees Celsius number that the president used in his remarks yesterday is patently wrong. And even the actual source of that information, the man who wrote the report, has said they used a number from the very beginning that did not account for all the contributions and commitments that the countries said that they were going to make. So if the Paris Agreement were carried out to its fullest extent, given all the goals that each nation set, scientists believe we would be able to hold ourselves to 1 degree warming. So that still doesn't get us to that mark where we want to be below 2 degrees Celsius. So yes, we would have to be more aggressive and continue to do more, but that's halfway there, and that's certainly progress.
Rob Meyer,
yeah, I think the number is 2.7 degrees Celsius. So if all countries held to their Paris commitments, we would have 2.7 degrees Celsius of warming. But the way Paris is designed is that we would then, starting in 2020, every country would bring a new commitment to the table, and hopefully that number would continue to decrease, especially as the markets and technology and the markets, by the way, supported by considerable government subsidy in Germany and China, reduce the cost of solar and wind power and make the 2-degree goal and hopefully the 1.5-degree goal more feasible.
We have a caller from Y Mills, Maryland. This is Kathy. Kathy, welcome to On Point. What do you think as you listen to this conversation?
Oh, hi. I was just going to talk to you about the point you made about will businesses take it upon themselves to adhere to the climate change commitment. There is a, I don't know if you've heard of the RE100. It's an alliance of influential businesses that have set pretty immediate goals for renewable energy. Included in those businesses are Bank of America, which is set to have 100% renewable energy by 2020. IKEA has set that as well. Coca-Cola has set their goal for 100% renewable energy by 2020. Bank of America is in there, Apple, Walmart, Goldman Sachs, Facebook. So businesses have already committed to renewable energy and realize that that's the wave of the future.
So does that make you think, Kathy, that yesterday's departure from the accord is not quite the tragedy that some people are calling it because efforts are already underway?
No. I think the withdrawal from the Paris Accord is definitely a tragic and very historically horrible move. I mean, for the United States ranks 40th out of 58 countries on the Climate Performance Index. So we talk about China. That's just three spots above China. I mean, I'm embarrassed right now for yesterday's withdrawal, but I do have to have hope somewhere. And I think that the RE100 is one place maybe we can have hope. The other bright spot was that California, the state of California, the state of Washington, the state of New York have formed the U.S. Climate Alliance, and they are going to commit to states that will adhere to the tenets of the Paris Agreement. So people are taking it upon themselves, businesses and states, because we no longer have the leadership.
Kathy, thank you for that. Let's go to Ken calling from Hillsborough, North Carolina. Ken, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thank you. I just think the rest of the world is upset with us right now because they just lost their cash cow for that whole program.
So you are not—you are clearly feeling like this was not sort of the tragic decision that we just heard from Kathy.
No. I mean, and then the gentleman that called from Belgium said that, you know,
the U.S. is going to be left behind. I hate to tell them, but we are the leader, the United States, in bringing down things like this and as working here in this country.
Although, you know, how do you feel, though, Ken, about the symbolic part of this? So we are a leader, as you just said, and part of that is showing other countries that we are trying to lead on this issue. And there has been concern that with the U.S. backing out, that might weaken the chance of other countries trying to meet their own goals, that they are unlikely to feel like they have to pursue as many efforts if the United States isn't. Do you feel like there could be that effect?
No, they... Look at Beijing. I mean, those people there should be going at their problem wholeheartedly. I mean, I don't want to walk around with a mask downtown, you know?
No. What do you mean by that? What do you mean about? Oh, you mean having to cover your mouth from breathing because of polluted air?
Yeah, I mean, the pictures of Beijing, I mean, you could look at it any day over there. The particulates are so high, people walking around with masks.
Ken, thanks for that. You mentioned Europe. I want to play a piece of tape from the president of the European Commission. This is Jean-Claude Juncker, and he spoke today at the European Union-China Business Summit in Brussels. And he said that even though the U.S. has left, there will be no backsliding, that they are going to be as committed as ever to the principles of trying to stop climate change.
Our joint leadership provides business, investors, and researchers, both in Europe, China, and throughout the world, with the certainty they need to build a global low-carbon economy. And it makes a statement to the world. There is no reverse gear to the energy transition. There is no backsliding on the Paris Agreement.
Rob Meyer of The Atlantic, your thoughts about whether this really does have the global implications that the people who are upset about withdrawing from the accord feel it will versus other people saying this is a good thing the United States got out of this?
You know, I think there's an entire conversation here that really goes to Ken's point that we're not having, which is that the renewable energy industry and renewable energy technology is something that the United States is being left behind on. You know, solar panels were developed during the space race, and it was something that the U.S. dominated in. It was an industry the U.S. dominated in up until the mid-1980s, at which point we lost dominance. Something that can happen as the result of the Paris Agreement and as a direct result of the Paris meetings is that China, and sometimes with European technology, can go to developing countries and offer them kind of a full slate of investment in their economy that then benefits these Chinese renewable firms. And then at that point, China then has kind of technological tentacles throughout their entire developing infrastructure. And that ultimately benefits Chinese renewable energy firms and brings down their costs.
Do you think the United States clean energy sector just got disadvantaged by this?
I think the United States clean energy sector just got profoundly disadvantaged by this. And I think that's something that state action from California and New York cannot really respond to, because states cannot bring the regulatory uniformity that the federal government can, and they can't bring the kind of diplomatic mojo that allows the State Department with private sector partners to go to developing countries and allow for U.S. investment there. And I think that's a huge national security aspect of this conversation that is often left out and that is really important for Americans to think about.
Let's go to a caller from New Orleans, Louisiana. This is Carol. Carol, welcome to On Point and your thoughts about the U.S. exiting the Paris Climate Accord.
Yes. Hello, Sasha. Yeah, my concern is I live in ground zero of climate change. We were the victims of broken levees, and water goes where it wants to. And to benefit the United States, we should listen to the scientists, because engineers can only do so much. But like the guy said, the regulatory agencies of the federal government are the arm. But let's see if the corporations who really and truly...
Carol, did we lose you? Carol, I think we've lost you. Orrin Cass, let me turn back to you, because we're clearly hearing a great deal of dismay. And again, we've heard you say if it was a symbolic pact, then it's really only a symbolic departure from the pact. But how do you talk down the many people that just feel like this was a tragedy, this was an embarrassment? I mean, there's a lot of that sentiment out there.
Well, you know, I think it's important to just keep returning back to concrete impacts and trying to understand what the concern is about, or if it's just kind of free-floating anxiety. You know, I think what Rob was just talking about with renewable energy is a good example. You know, the idea that China is putting huge amounts of state industrial policy behind renewable energy, putting huge amounts of government finance into investing in developing countries, that's all true. That has nothing to do with Paris. And whether or not the U.S. was in or out of Paris, it is a totally separate and distinct challenge that we are competing economically on the global stage against countries like China that are pursuing a very different model. So, you know, I think Rob like used the term diplomatic mojo. You know, frankly, I don't know what that means. I think there are certainly countries that in the short run are going to express their displeasure with what the U.S. has done here. But, you know, countries' interests are still countries' interests, and the U.S. still brings everything to the table in other areas that it would have anyway. And I especially just have to laugh when, you know, we hear from the EU leader talking about how he's going to, you know, recommit the EU without the U.S. Well, the reality is that, you know, transport environment just looked at the EU countries and all but three of them aren't even in line with their own commitments. EU emissions are going up. And so it's really important to get down one level from just the international diplomacy of feeling good and going to meetings to looking at what's actually happening, what the agreement actually says, how little it was worth, and how little interest the U.S. actually had in being a part of it.
That's Orrin Cass. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank. His work focuses in part on energy and the environment. Also with us has been Christy Goldfuss, former managing director of the White House Council on Environmental Quality under President Obama, and Rob Meyer, who writes about climate change for The Atlantic. Thank you to all three of you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.